Podo. You're listening to The Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat.
Hello and welcome to The Election Tricycle, a show about elections, especially elections in the USA, India and the UK, all of which are happening this year, and some of the other elections that are going on in 2024, which is to say hundreds and hundreds of them. I'm Tom Hamilton in London. I'm joined by Emily Tamkin in Washington, D.C. and Rohan Venkat in Cairo. And we're going to kick off this week with some news of very significant development in the Indian election, which is to say that we now know when it's going to be. Take it away, Rohan.
Thanks, Tom. Yes, it's a properly officially election season in India. The Election Commission of India this week announced the dates. India is going to be going to the polls between April 19th and June 1st, and we're going to have the results out counting on June 4th. That's a 44-day period, and also that means from now on, we're officially in election season, campaigning, all of that is supposed to officially start now. That's a long, complex period, and we're going to spend all of the next episode discussing how exactly the Indian election is structured, why it's so long, what goes into all of this. But all of that is next week, so do stay tuned if that's something you're curious about. But this week, we're going a bit further afield from the elections that we generally talk about every week. We have Emily taking us to another part of the world where we have elections.
That's right. So obviously, gang, we mostly focus on our three countries' elections, but this is a wild year for elections all over the world. And this coming Saturday is the first round of the Slovak presidential elections, which I think are worth paying close attention to, both for what they mean for Slovakia and also just the deep resonances that I see between what's happening there and what's happening elsewhere, including in my own country. So this week for that, I spoke with Dalibor Rohats of the American Enterprise Institute. He's a senior fellow there. And this was our interview. Dalibor, thank you for being with me today.
Thanks for having me, Emily. I'm glad to be here as a recovering Slovak.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so basically, you know, the sort of the lay of the land, as I understand it, is this. Back in 2018, so several years ago now, after many months of anti-corruption protests, the Prime Minister, Robert Fica, was finally forced to resign. He resigned. The immediate impetus for this was the murder of investigative journalist Jan Kuciak and his fiance. He is replaced by a seemingly more moderate member of his party, right, Smer, Peter Pellegrini. In 2020, there's an anti-corruption wave and a new anti-corruption, you know, sort of center-right, if you like, coalition comes to power in Slovakia. And there's also a new president, Zuzana Čaputová, who also runs on an anti-corruption platform. This fervor does not last. And last year in Slovakia's parliamentary elections, Robert Fica comes back to power. Pellegrini, who after 2020 had formed his own party, he becomes speaker of Slovakia's parliament or national council. But now Pellegrini, so this is a sort of sometime ally of Fica, who is back as prime minister, having been forced out after the murder of a journalist. Pellegrini is the front runner in these presidential campaigns, the first round of which is March 23rd. Is that sort of where we're at?
I think that's basically correct. I would add that really since Slovakia's emergence as an independent country, its politics has been divided between two similarly sized blocks, which will sound very familiar to a American or British listener. Mm-hmm. There has been a vaguely populist, nationalist, anti-immigrant, anti-US, rural, less educated bloc. And then there is this sort of progressive, liberal, urban, you know, high achievers, and so on and so forth bloc. And these sort of specifics would differ election to election. Even political parties and leaders would differ from election to election. Slovakia's politics has never been properly institutionalized. So the sort of landscape of political parties in 2024 would be virtually unrecognizable to a time traveler from year 2004.
Sure.
But the sort of broad contours have always been there, and elections and various sort of political crises have always been sort of resolved by the level of relative mobilization of those two blocks. So in 2018, as you mentioned, there was this twin murder that occurred at the behest presumably of a mobster connected to Fico's government at the time. Lots of people took to the streets. Fico was forced out. And on the back of it in 2019, Zuzana Čaputová, who had been a sort of anti-corruption activist and the founding member of Progressive Slovakia, a sort of central-left liberal technocratic party that had just been founded. So she was sort of propelled to presidency. So she decided not to run 5 years later. That's a sort of separate story. But that has sort of set the stage for this election in which you have Pellegrini, who is the kind of suave, civilized, smooth face of this governing coalition, and Ivan Korčok, who served as Slovakia's ambassador to the US. He had been a career diplomat throughout much of his professional life. And he also served relatively recently, around 2022, as Slovakia's foreign minister. This election is simultaneously a very low stakes one, in the sense that the figure of the president is largely a ceremonial one, and neither of the two candidates is a particularly divisive, offensive, you know, difficult figure. But it's also a very high stakes one because it comes at a very peculiar political moment for Slovakia, when I think more and more people are sort of asking themselves, both in the country and outside of the country, you know, where Slovakia belongs, whether it's still part of the Western alliance, or whether it's trying to follow in the footsteps of Viktor Orban in Hungary, whether it's trying to forge deeper ties with Moscow and so on and so forth. And really the question is whether the sort of complacency which would sort of normally characterize the presidential election, you know, would be outweighed by the sort of urgency of this political moment. As of now, it looks like a very tight race, but I think it's very hard to sort of predict which way it's going to go.
Right. I mean, it's my understanding that Pellegrini at different points has sort of presented himself as like a more moderate alternative to Fico, and then, oh, wait, no, like, never mind, I'm here standing with Orban. Like, so thus, if you're the populist base, you should still vote for me. How would you say he's running in this election?
Well, he's almost trying not to run, or almost trying to sort of nurture this sort of ambiguity about who he is, which is very much in line with how politically successful presidents ran in the past. So there was one president in Slovak history who was re-elected for a second term. That was Ivan Gašparovič, who was a guy who, much like Pellegrini, was Mečiar's sidekick in the 1990s.
And Mečiar, we should say, just very quickly, was the leader of Slovakia in the 1990s, who, I mean, during the period that Madeleine Albright said it was the black hole of Europe and kidnapped his political opponent's son, or had his political opponent's son kidnapped, and so on and so forth.
And he was really sort of like, he was a populist, authoritarian populist before there was real authoritarian populism. So he was a, you know, real trailblazer in that sense. And so Gašparovič, sort of after 1998, sort of split away from Mečiar, formed his own movement. And he, you know, he was kind of reactionary enough to appeal to that sort of rural anti-Western base without being too offensive for the urban, educated, liberal intelligentsia, that he was able to sort of strike that balance. Like, he was a widely ridiculed figure, but that's almost like the sweet spot for being a president in Slovak politics.
Right.
And Pellegrini is, he's obviously much more eloquent and suave and charming and so on and so forth. But he, I think, is trying to sort of occupy that same spot. So he, you know, like he would tell different things to different audiences. He would, you know, make sure that he does not really mobilize real anger on the side of the people who are concerned about Fico and sort of incumbent entrenchment and Slovakia's drift to the east. But yet would have a sort of hold on that sort of nationalist rural electorate.
Right. I guess the question is, I mean, there have been mass protests, certainly in Bratislava, since there's been a new Fico government, because he's trying to pass through certain judicial reforms that many would argue would make it more difficult to hold elected officials to account for corruption. And, you know, some are concerned that he's going in a more pro-Russian direction. How much of that anger in the streets do you think will translate to the presidential election in anti-Pellegrini votes?
So I think that's the million-dollar question, because when Fico returned last year, he returned embittered, keen to have his sort of political vendettas. he considered his ouster in 2018 as a color revolution, supposedly orchestrated by Soros and the U.S. embassy in Bratislava. And I think he has really become radicalized in his years out of power. And so he came back with, first and foremost, the intention of protecting himself from any criminal prosecutions and protecting people within his inner circle. So this criminal code reform was adopted, which really brought people to the streets. You had protests on a weekly basis going on since November until the recent past. It has sort of petered out in recent weeks, which might be good news for Pellegrini. At the same time, there's been this outreach to Russia. So Slovakia's foreign minister met with Sergei Lavrov on the sidelines of a meeting in Turkey. More recently, the legal status of Slovak public broadcasting is being sort of revoked, essentially. And both the public TV and public radio are going to be brought under direct government control. So these are all things that, you know, would point out in the direction of opposition being really mobilized and ringing the alarm bells. Yet when you look at the opinion polls, it is quite striking that Pellegrini and Korczok are tied very closely in a situation in which Korczok is really the only viable opposition candidate.
So last question, can you tell us a bit more about this one viable opposition candidate and what you expect to see not only this in this first round, but in the second round as well?
Well, so that's the thing. So you would think that the Slovakia sort of opposition is, you know, that appreciates the seriousness of the moment and has sort of learned the lessons of the past, has learned the lessons from, you know, various elections in Hungary. And there has been this real effort to sort of, you know, present one viable candidate, unite behind him. And that's for all practical purposes, Korczok. Like, there's nobody else in that sort of pro-Western field who has a striking chance of getting anywhere near presidency. Yet when you look back at 2019, when Čaputová ran, who had not been a widely known figure in the country when she announced she was running for president, you had at a similar point in the campaign her already with a very comfortable sort of majority, with a very comfortable margin ahead of the Fico candidate of the moment, who was a different guy. It was also similarly sort of like inoffensive.
Yeah.
Sort of face of the governing coalition. And so you had a much more fractured, much more diverse opposition field. And yet she had this comfortable margin. Korczok doesn't have that. So in spite of everything I just said about, you know, the opposition mobilizing against, you know, Fico's following in the footsteps of Viktor Orban, it's almost as if the general public were not on the same page. It's almost as if that complacency around the election was sort of setting in. And I think it bodes poorly for Korczok, frankly, for the second round, because he doesn't have that many sort of groups of voters to go to. So there's a third party candidate, which is at around 11-12%. His name is Stefan Harabin, who is a conspiracy theory monger and a very sort of peculiar anti-establishment figure. It's very unlikely that a large fraction of his electorate would go to Korczok. It's more likely for them to flock to Pellegrini, particularly if Korczok is depicted, as he's likely to be depicted, as a sort of agent of American influence or whatnot. So in my mind, Korczok now has, you know, a couple of days before the first round and then 2 weeks until the second round to make, you know, as forceful case as he can possibly make for why this election matters and for why, I mean, the governing coalition needs a sort of countervailing force within the constitutional system in the figure of the president. And whether he can succeed, I think, is an open question.
All right. Well, we will leave it on that open question. Dalibor from AEI and for covering Slovak, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me today.
Emily, thank you.
Okay. So that was that. That was Slovakia. You know, I just, as an American, I just see such a strong, I just see so many parallels with, you know, a leader who's been accused of this and that and is then allowed to come back into power and the way in which he sort of gets back to what he was doing, but more forcefully. But in addition, as he was speaking, what he said about, you know, the opposition stays out for weeks and weeks, but at some point you become complacent. At some point there isn't sort of same fire in the belly of the protesters. You know, it reminded me, Rohan, of some of what you've been saying about, you know, for example, there was a case where a person who was meant to be counting ballots in India. We spoke about this a few weeks ago, was caught on camera. And years ago, this would have been a big, huge, like a huge issue. And today it's just not. And I was wondering, as you listened to the interview, whether you thought there were parallels there as well between sort of an unlikely pairing, but between Slovakia and India.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about Slovak politics, but there was lots interesting in there to think about. And for sure, in India, there are parallels on some things, particularly the sense that some elections can go by with people not necessarily absorbing or not being willing to accept save democracy kind of appeal, when maybe after a while they're just more focused on immediate issues. I think over the years in India, political parties have often spoken of the right as being a threat to democracy, and then at various times done deals with folks like that. They've been seen as being cushy with the same sets of politicians. That's not necessarily the case today, but it has meant that it sort of tempers the appeal to voters to go out and vote on the basis of a simple principle, let's say, rather than what we would call bread and butter issues. And I think that's something the opposition in India will struggle with. It's one of the things on which they've sought to build a platform. Given that there's so much infighting in India on the opposition side, it's struggling to take hold. But I don't think it's limited to India. I get the sense that, you know, in the US, there's the same concern that Joe Biden pulling the, like, Trump will hurt America's democracy is not enough to get people out to the polls.
100%. I think America, the United States is in a very difficult position right now, I think, because every election is presented as you have to come out and vote. You only have one option and you have to do this in order to save democracy. And I think that that's both actually a valid argument. You know, like, if you listen to what Trump is saying, I think that's true. You know, the fact that he tried to dispute the elections, the results of the last presidential election, and the reports that have come out about the way that he's, you know, intends to attack the civil service, and so on. It's like, I genuinely do believe that. But it's not enough to, like, you also can't tell people that that's all they get every 2 to 4 years. Is like, if you come out and vote, you'll get the privilege of another chance to come out and vote, right? Like, that's sort of not an affirmative enough case. And I think you do have, you know, you're having people who are like, oh, what, is this also the most important election? You know, and it's both wrong, because it is, like, everyone is sort of, does end up becoming the most important election. But they're also right in that, like, and actually, I do think that this happened in Slovakia as well. You know, this sort of anti-Fica, anti-corruption government came into power. And what do they do with it? Right? Like, it wasn't enough. It's not enough to say, well, we're not a mafia state, and so therefore we deserve to be in power. I mean, I guess I wish I had a better answer for my own country. But I totally think that we must save democracy fatigue is real.
It's a really striking contrast with the UK, actually, because, you know, we've got our problems, but no one is claiming that democracy is on the ballot in the forthcoming elections, because no one thinks that it is. There are minor issues around the edges. There are attempts by the government to slightly restrict, not restrict the franchise, but make it slightly harder for people to vote. So you need voter ID now in a way that you didn't in previous elections. There are potential issues about that suppressing some votes in an asymmetric way. And Sadiq Khan, who's the mayor of London, who's standing for re-election in a couple of months, has warned that voter ID could suppress his vote by as much as 5%. No one is taking that very seriously. People think that's a huge overstatement of the problem. You know, the number of people who are turned away from voting because of not having ID in previous local elections was well under 0.5%, which is still a lot of people. But those whole, you know, vote now because it could be the last election of your lifetime, that is just not alive in this country. Whoever wins the general election, no one believes that they will attempt to cancel democracy. And in one sense, that lowers the stakes a bit, but in another sense, it's obviously fairly healthy. But it does mean that, you know, all parties still want to say, this is the most important election of your lifetime. The Labour Party wants to say, we're at a crossroads. This could change everything. Either we take a stride into the broad sunlit uplands under Labour, or we go backwards under the Tories. And of course they want to say that. And they may or may not be right, but it is not at all an existential threat message.
I mean, that's, yeah, one would hope that in a democracy, an election can be very, very important and that there can be real differences on substantive issues without democracy itself being one of those issues. Like that's not
absolutely,
you know, good for the UK. That's how this is supposed to work. I will say that as an outsider, I thought a huge moment in British politics was when Boris Johnson had been called out for all of these various COVID breaches and people were saying resign, resign, resign. And they didn't actually have a mechanism to force him out. And eventually pressure became enough that he did step down. And to me, that was like, oh, there's still shame, right, in British politics, which is actually, I think, a hugely, like, that is a hugely important thing that you can be shamed into respecting the rules of the game, which I don't think we can anymore.
Yes, in as much as the public were absolutely outraged by that, and that was the thing that lost Boris Johnson's support in the eyes of the general public, it wasn't what forced him out of office. What forced him out of office was the fact that enough ministers resigned from the government over quite a short period that it was literally impossible for him to form a government anymore, or it was getting to that point, and he found that he had to resign. And the precipitating issue for that was not the parties, although that hugely weakened him. It was the way that he completely mismanaged an issue with a junior minister who was accused of sexual harassment.
Yes, I remember that, and it was around the same time, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Quite shortly afterwards. So he was weak. And then he tried to defend someone who was, you know, credibly accused of quite serious sexual misbehavior and made, as I say, made people go out on the airwaves and defend it, which is obviously one of the most dangerous moments for any prime minister is if you have a line, you send people out to defend the line on the radio and on TV, and it's not a credible line and they sound a bit stupid and they've humiliated themselves. And then the line changes.
Right.
Because you've made them look, you've made them sound stupid once, and then you've made them sound stupid twice.
But this is what I'm saying. Like, we don't have that anymore, right? These people are constantly going out and humiliating themselves and being attacked by the presidential candidate and then coming back and endorsing him the next day. Like, the normal rules, what were once the rules of politics. And listen, there's a lot for the good old days that I do not hearken for. Like, I do not think the problems with the Republican Party started with Trump. You know, I do not think that like the 90s were some perfect time or the early, like, I'm not saying any of that. What I am saying is that there used to be normal rules of politics that like have simply not held anymore. Now, we have seen so far in American politics that the institutions are still holding to a certain extent, right? Trump was not able to steal the election. Like, people are still able to go to vote. And the concern that I have is that should Trump be reelected, not only will the normal rules of politics not apply, the institutional dam will break this time. And I think that's sort of what Dalibor was talking about in Slovakia. And granted, he was like, our institutions weren't as strong or as established or, you know, this and that, but they come back in and it's like, okay, well, I've already got de facto, let me get de jure on my side now.
There's a smaller version of this that has played out in India over the last 30 years. We've spoken in the past about a big jump in the right wing, the Hindu right managing to get a big jump in their support in the 90s because of the demolition of the mosque. And a lot of parties fell on this secular versus Hindu right divide. And a lot of parties would ask people to go out to the polls to defend the secular nature of India's politics and assumed, for example, that basically Muslims would vote for them en masse to keep the Hindu right out. Over time, when it started to be seen as being very cynically used, people got disillusioned with it, and then the right was able to use it as like, oh, this is appeasement. This is just a way they keep a vote bank. And so it didn't work either in the favor over time of those who kept using that as the way of getting people out to vote. And it worked in the favor of those who are against it, saying, oh, this is just a cynical tactic. So there are genuine like downsides to portraying things also in this way that we've seen playing out in India, where it might both be true, but it may also not just be the best way to get people out to vote without offering maybe a more positive, you know, alternative vision and things like that.
Yeah, it's like the sky is falling, right? And like, in truth, the sky didn't fall in part because people came out and voted. But what they see is like, oh, the sky is still there. And also all around me, things are the same. So why should I keep listening to you?
One thing that really interests me about the American situation is how far this is a permanent shift and how far this is just Trump. So, I mean, we've talked a lot about Biden being old, but Trump is also pretty old. If Trump doesn't win this year, he hasn't got too many more goes at it, you'd say. Once he stops being a central player or a candidate, do you think at that point the Republican Party goes back a bit more to the kind of more mainstream centre-right party that we are a bit more used to seeing in the future? Or is it a Trump-shaped party for the foreseeable future?
So as a person who enjoys living in a democracy or a democratic republic or whatever you want to call it, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that we saw in 2022, when Trump wasn't on the ballot and there wasn't like one singular figure around whom election denial claims could work or rotate or whatever, that these claims didn't stick, right? Like it was sort of the air was out of the balloon. Yeah, some people claimed it. It didn't really matter. And mostly people accepted the results of the election. However, we also saw that year that often very extreme candidates won their primaries. And perhaps at a certain point, you know, that shifts backwards. The bad news, I would say, is that if you look at younger Republicans, they're quite extreme. Like they're quite far right. And so if you look at who's getting pushed out in the Republican Party at this moment, it's people who I think probably would consider themselves more center-right or just like more what used to be considered a mainstream Republican. Again, I'm not trying to valorize these people at all. I do not like their policies, but they could lose an election and concede defeat, right? That's not nothing. They're getting pushed out. And the people coming up are like, you know, it grew up in Trump's Republican Party. So I think for this to get better, like he has to be out. He can't still be a major political force. The fever has to break, and it cannot break if he's there being like, we're all still sick. But should that not happen, there is a whole crop coming up of people who see things more in the way of Trump than in the way of, I don't know, Romney, right?
Tucker Carlson 2029, huh?
Oh, God, Ron, go knock on wood, go find an evil eye. Yeah, I'm not apologizing for that. I stand by that. Tucker Carlson should not be president of the United States. That's a partisan take that I will stand behind. All right. Well, now that I've depressed myself, with that discussion of India, the US, the UK, and Slovakia, we have to leave it there. Premium listeners, hang on. For the rest of you, please like, subscribe, tell a friend, tell a hater, tell Tucker Carlson. Please come back next week where we're going to talk about how our elections are actually run with a special focus on the Indian election. So it's coming up. Rohan's going to walk us through all of it, and we'll see you next week.
The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin, and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024 and watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@podopods.com. podopods.com.